All right, a quick announcement. As you know, Mike and Susan won't have all their stuff here till probably Wednesday of next week. And let's hope they get that on time. Don't say, "Whoop, we lost your pod." It'll be another week. I always fear the worst. Plan for the best, you know, but fear the worst. So, at any rate, so they may have need of a few things, and I've told them, you know, just contact anybody if you need something. Like, I'm going to donate a spatula, but it was as little as I could do. So, I feel free to contact anybody. We'll help. I'm sure most of you will, so I have good confidence in that. All right, let's go ahead and make sure you are in fellowship. If somebody got you out on break by saying something mean to you, now's the time to rebound. Forgive them and move on. Here we're dealing with this matter of the doctrine of the day of the Lord and the term day, which we first have to define. And what we find out is it's not literal. It can be used figuratively, metaphorically, where the terms evening and morning aren't. They are technical. They mean the same thing in every context. So we looked at and finished up there with as the day, the phrase there, point C, major point 1C2. The days of is used to denote the span of time during which a person has lived and the reign of a king. Three here, it is used of an indefinite period, as seen in the following phrases. Psalm 21, most of these phrases I put right there in it. So you don't necessarily have to look up the verses, you can, but they're there. The day of trouble. May the Lord answer you in the day of trouble, whenever that day may be, whatever that time may be. It's not technical for any particular day. It's general for whenever it happens. The day of war and battle, that's also seen in Job 38:23. The day of salvation. And obviously a day of war and battle, you don't have a warfare that lasts, well, we're fixing to have one, but you don't normally have a warfare that lasts a day. Now that would be a battle perhaps, but even battles could be protracted and last much longer. Particularly under a situation like where a city was under siege, that was never done in a day. That had to take weeks and months to kind of try to smoke them out or starve them out or whatever you were doing, or attack the fortress. So it's used of the day of salvation. That's seen in 2 Corinthians 6:2. Behold, now is the acceptable time, he says. Behold, now is the day of salvation. Well, the day of salvation is in a sense every day. It's not just a single day. God, as we know, in his grace, is providing time and space for people to make the adjustments to his plan, particularly the salvation adjustment. God is patient, as Peter says there, and is allowing time for people to change their minds. Now, if they won't change their mind, that's on them, but God gives them ample time to do so. So the day of salvation there. D, it is used in a figurative sense to denote a general time of opportunity, which is not to be limited to a particular day. Now in this context, Jesus is actually speaking, John chapter 9, of the reality to where we are all headed, and that is physical death. Absent the rapture, every one of us will die. The rapture would be the only thing that will deliver you from that. We all are infected with the death gene, as we know. The old sin nature, the genetics of the flesh have been altered to where now death is a reality. Physical death is probably man's greatest fear. Here he talks about, in Jesus' case, they're going to see, here it was the question about the man born blind. And he says, we must work the works of him who sent me as long as it is day. And night is coming when no one will work. Well, here, night and day refer to the period of death and life. You can do things while you're alive. You can't do them once you're dead. Once you're dead, it's finished. So night is coming when no one can work. Essentially, while you're alive, now is the time to apply. Now, is today the day to do it? Yes. Yes, this literal day is. But that would extend into the future as well. Every day is a day to apply. So, therefore, there is sufficient biblical evidence to indicate that the term day is used regularly throughout the Bible to refer to a time that is more or less than 24 hours. Generally, it's more. And yet, most conservative commentators have long recognized the phrase, the day of the Lord, is not referring to one literal day in human history. Some have defined the day of the Lord as a special phrase in the Bible, used to refer to an extended period of history when God directly intervenes in human affairs, in judgment and in blessing. The time of patience is over. The time of grace is gone. God is going to intervene and give the human race what it deserves. Both, in a sense, for those who are positive, a blessing. We will experience the full aspect of the day of the Lord, the millennial kingdom. Whereas the other people, the negative unbelievers, are only going to experience the aspect of the day of the Lord, the destruction that comes from the Almighty. That's all they're going to get of it. So that's a pretty good way of defining it to me, because God is openly now, no longer gracing people out, as it were. I mean, that's not to say there's still not grace in all of this, but in large measure, God is taking off the gloves and is going to deal with the human race as it deserves to be dealt with, as it has lies, as we might say, as John says, it lies in the lap of the wicked one, or on the chest of the wicked one. The human race, unfortunately, is comfortable with Satan and his doctrines. We are not. We never fit here. We're not supposed to fit here. This is not our home. We are aliens and strangers. We are merely passing through. We're only visiting this planet. And we will go at some point. Either via the rapture or physical death, we'll be out of here. Now, either way, you get raptured, whether you die or not, you still get raptured. But the point is, if you're alive, then you don't face the specter of physical death. So, while there are differences of opinion with respect to when this day of the Lord begins and when it ends, this definition is certainly accurate. And again, what happens, as we know, is when the day of the Lord begins, it is comprised, there it starts, kicks off here in the middle of Daniel's 70th week. Here you've got the 7 years, final 7 years. The day of the Lord kicks off here and then extends out for 1,000 years and maybe plus a little. We don't know. We don't know if it ends technically. I haven't seen anything that tells me specifically it ends technically right out at 1,000 years. But this period of 3.5 years has to be included in it, because the day of the Lord comes as destruction. This doesn't deal with destruction at all. This deals with the great circumstances that we read about, the great conditions that come to pass after the second advent, when the earth is restored. By the time God's finished with it, this place is going to be a dump. But it takes all this to eject its previous owner, the squatter, Satan. This is not his planet. He does not own it by virtue of ownership, by creation. God does. And it's all God's. And Satan has moved in and taken over. Well, if we talk about, there are tenant-friendly states in which if you're a scumbag lowlife who doesn't pay rent, it's very hard to get rid of you. And they make it very difficult for to get tenants out of both. And Florida is one, believe me. And I make it, you got to jump through a lot of hoops. I remember when I worked out at the industrial park, even if people weren't paying rent, it took us months to get rid of them. You couldn't just go in there and get rid of them. You can't just change the locks and leave their stuff in there. That's all illegal. Shouldn't be. If they won't pay rent and they want their stuff left there, that's their call. But you're not allowed to do that. Well, God has given Satan every opportunity. He squats here, but he's going to be ejected. That's going to be part of his falls. Again, this is the last, next to last one, when he's confined here at the outset of this to the abyss, where he's tossed in there and sealed, and he can't get out. So, this is further confirmed by the Hebrew term eth, actually, time, which is a word that refers to time in the sense of an opportunity or season, a period of time. Ezekiel 33. And of course, in the context here, this deals with the day of the Lord. For the day is near. Sometimes the phrase the day of the Lord is shortened to just what it has here, the day. And the reader's expected to know what that is, although here, Ezekiel further defines it. even the day of the Lord. It will be a day of clouds, a time of doom for the nations. And so we recognize that a time doesn't mean a day. It means some extended period. And in this case, it's 3.5 years of time that they have once this kicks off. Now, it could be, again, I don't know when it happens, but I know that in Revelation, it says they would no longer repent. They would no longer change their minds about their behavior. And that means no salvation for them. And again, whether that kicks off prior to the day of the Lord, at the day of the Lord, or after, I couldn't say. It's limited to a pretty small period, that I can tell you. It has to be limited to a small time. But here we have a time. And this means a time, as in more than a day, obviously, of doom. And again, this is one of the things the Old Testament prophets struggled with. They struggled with two things particularly. One, the contrast between the Messiah, the suffering servant of Isaiah 53, say, and the great glory that's described for this servant. And so they struggled with how could you reconcile this great suffering and bearing the sins of many with all the millennial passages that deal with Messiah's reign, his glory, his exaltation, his kingdom, and all of that. And they couldn't reconcile these things in their thinking. But what they missed was, obviously, there's a span of time, the church age, that they didn't see or know anything about. The Old Testament prophets were not privy to this. They knew something was up, but they didn't know what. And Peter even talks about that. They did not understand the time or the manner of the dispensation that they were looking at. And they couldn't. And another thing that's hard to reconcile for them is that the day of the Lord is comprised of these two very specific things. Really, really bad stuff and really, really good stuff. So how do you deal with that? And so, again, whether they reconciled it or not, because of the grace of God, the ministry of the Spirit, we're able to. Where we live in history, we have the great blessing of having much fuller revelation, the most full revelation anybody's ever had. And so, obviously, we're very culpable with this kind of grace and knowledge. Well, one, the word is used of regular events, such as the rainy season. Ezra 10:13. And we might, and of course, what you've got actually in the Hebrew, I believe, if I remember right, is the time of rain. The time of rain or showers. Actually, it's a plural. The time of rain or showers. But there are many people. It is, quote, the rainy season. And that is just simply the F with the construct form coupled with rain or showers. And we are not able to stand in the open. It's used of the time of the harvest. Jeremiah, now this obviously is in one of the passages we're going to cover in regard to this doctrine. Jeremiah 50:16. Cut off the sower from Babylon and the one who wields the sickle. Again, as we saw in the book of Revelation. Again, the reason I did that first was just to set the context and to demonstrate that without a doubt, Babylon and these passages has to be placed in the last days in the time of Daniel's 70th week. You wouldn't get that necessarily from these passages, although you could figure out certainly that it has to do with the day of the Lord. That part you could figure out. Well, as we saw there, every category of humanity in Babylon is going to suffer. And this just all these just pile up. Of everybody that's going to suffer. The sower is the farmer, obviously. The one who wields the sickle at the time of the harvest. And again, that's not just a day. Harvest lasts, it depends kind of on where you are. I remember back when I was a kid, living with my cousin out in Hera, out in Oklahoma. And when it came time to haul hay, there was a particular season towards the end of summer. And you haven't lived till you've hauled hay in the 110 degree Oklahoma heat. And when you go in the barn and it's 140. But if you're 16, 17, 18 like I was, well, you're more suited for it. I wouldn't want to do it today. And so there was a period of time we knew we had to, shall I say it, make hay while the sun shines. We had to get out and make the money then because the hay couldn't stay in the field and there was a period of time that you're limited to. You've got to get the crops in. So here it's also used, so cut off from the one who wields the sickle at the time of the harvest. The time of migration, Jeremiah chapter 8. There's a time, as you know, and it's not a day, but it's a time of migration. It's a period where animals relocate themselves. Even the stork in the sky knows her seasons. And the turtle dove and the swift and the thrush observe the time of their migration. And actually what you have here is two different words that actually relate to this. Moed. Moed actually means a fixed period of time. And then eth, a general period of time. But again, the birds don't migrate all the time. There's a period they do it and a period where they stay where they're at. So it is linked point two with the phrase in those days to denote the extended time of Israel's restoration and prosperity under Messiah. Now here we're into the day of the Lord proper, as it were. Not that we're not there in the destruction part of it, but the real emphasis of the day of the Lord is blessing. But in order to get there, he has to do a lot of destroying. And this is true, as we talked about when we're looking at this passage about being built up, being renewed in the spirit of your mind, in Romans 12 there when we went through that, and reprogramming the brain computer and all of that. So that takes time. It doesn't happen quickly. And you wouldn't say that would be done in a day by any stretch. So this era of prosperity here comes at a particular time. Jeremiah 33:15, in those days and at that time. And actually that phrase, at that time, is also, as a matter of fact, did I include that? I didn't, but that's also another phrase, at that time, that deals very often. Again, you have to check context. But in the context here, it's referring to the reign of Messiah. In the days of those, literally, in the Hebrew. That's a typical Hebrew word order, noun first and then adjective second. At that time, prefix bait here with the term eighth. I will cause a righteous branch of David to spring forth, and he shall execute justice and righteousness on the earth. Also, chapter 50. Again, some of these are clearly in the context of Babylon. But it's the primary point of destruction just prior to the day of the Lord. I mean, it kicks the whole thing off, we might say. Jeremiah 54, in those days and at that time, the sons of Israel will come, they and the sons of Judah as well. And they will go along, weeping as they go. And it will be the Lord their God they will seek. And they will ask for the way to Zion, turning their faces in that direction. Now clearly this refers to the period of immigration back to Israel, which is, I think, dramatically speeded up once the rapture happens. That the word goes out in Babylon and the Jews here, and we have a pretty significant Jewish population in America. They run everything. They're the evil of the world. We know it. I'm kidding, of course. Anti-Semitism has no place, really, in any of this. But they start this immigration. Obviously, it's been underway for some time. But they're not here. They're going back to Zion, repentant and humble. This isn't like the immigration that's been going on since the establishment of the nation in 48. This is a particular period in which they come, in which they've got their spiritual act together. And we know that does not occur until after the rapture. Then we resort, again, the church age has been a parenthesis, in the age of Israel. And then we resort, but we don't, but the world does, back to the conditions and the rules and all that of the age of Israel. So my suspicion is that first, believers don't get the indwelling of the Spirit like we have it in the church age, because they didn't have that in the age of Israel. And if conditions go back to that, then they'll still be saved, but there'll be certain things that are changed for them. And certainly they're not considered to be a part of the church, nor in replacement theology does the church become Israel. Covenant theology is wrong, 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 wrong. It's just not correct. To substitute the church for Israel or Israel for the church violates the nature. And it's clear there in the book of Revelation when we get to the final chapters. There you have both the apostles mentioned, the church as it were, they're the foundation stones, and then the gates are all named after the sons of Israel. And so you have this city in which the church and Israel live together forever, the New Jerusalem. So chapter 4 there also, chapter 20, or verse 20, same book. In those days and at that time, declares the Lord, search will be made for the iniquity of Israel, but there will be none. And for the sins of Judah, but they will not be found. For I will pardon those whom I leave as a remnant. And so clearly, this deals with the spiritual restoration of Israel, which we know, according to Ezekiel 37, comes after the physical restoration to the land. The vision there of the dry bones. Can these dry bones live? And he says, the bones come all together and they're assembled, as it were. The nation is being reassembled, but there's no life in it. It's laying there on the ground. And so Ezekiel is told, prophesy and tell the four winds of heaven to come and breathe life into these bones. And they do. And this is analogous to Israel's spiritual restoration. And that occurs certainly as you're headed into the day of the Lord, the millennial part of it. That doesn't occur necessarily during the time. I mean, they may be recovering at that point. It's hard to say. The 144,000 are all Jews. We know that. And so how big of an impact will this have on the Jewish people? Well, again, only a remnant will be saved. We know that. Not all of them. Not even most of them. But that remnant is what God is looking for. And also Joel 3:1. For behold, in those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem, I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And I will enter into judgment with them on behalf of my people and my inheritance Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have divided up my land. Palestinians don't want to read this because it's not their land. And they have flipped this. There's a new deal going on. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's DFV or something, divest, something. There's this new movement going on. It's gaining real traction in America. And it's clearly anti-Semitic. It's a boycott against the Jews. You boycott everything Jewish. You don't talk to them. You don't look at them. You don't buy from them. You don't any nothing. And it's flagrant anti-Semitism. And because they say, well, this land is ours and the Jews are squatters. Oop, you got it just backwards. The land is theirs and you're squatters. God has not rescinded the promise to Abraham. The title deed goes to him for that land. I'm going to give it to you and your descendants forever. And certainly, at the bare minimum, that does refer to his physical descendants. Also, as we know, his spiritual descendants, the seed, is in there as well. Well, vocabulary terms here. Hebrew terms, the phrase Yom Yahweh, Day of the Lord, is found 15 times in the Old Testament. And is the most common designation for the Day of the Lord. This phrase is often qualified by other descriptive terms or phrases to denote various aspects of the day of the Lord. And again, you can look these passages up, but I emphasized them here in the notes of what we're looking for. And that's a day of the Lord is cruel. That doesn't sound like blessing to me. With fury and burning anger. Isaiah 13:9. And from time to time, I know you can hear it as I deal with some of this stuff. I get pretty riled up over this stuff. Well, so's God. That's a sign of spiritual health. You ought to be riled up over some of the things that are going on. Some of the things our nation is doing and has done. And that's one we'll get. As a matter of fact, we're coming up to that. Cruel with fury and burning anger to make the land a desolation. First, again, starting with Babylon, but he's not done. That's just the warm-up. And then it gets really nasty after that. And he will exterminate its sinners from it. Just like an exterminator goes around after vermin. This is what mankind has become, a bunch of vermin. That filthy up the planet. And God's going to get rid of them. They're not going to any longer do this to his creation. It's also called the great day of the Lord. Zephaniah there, 1:14. Near is the great day of the Lord. Near and coming very quickly. Listen, the day of the Lord. In it, the warrior cries out bitterly. All the armies of the world, all the military are going to be decimated everywhere, beginning with ours, of course. But Russia is smart enough to know not to leave any way for us to strike back. That's why I'm convinced that every military installation will be a target, every place we've got anything of any significance. And again, given the fact that they have 7,000 warheads at this point, they've got plenty of firepower. That's 7,000 that we know about. Could Russia be doing anything we don't know about? Could they? Yes. It's called great and very awesome. Joel 2:11. The Lord utters his voice before his army. Surely his camp is very great, for strong is he who carries out his word. The day of the Lord is indeed great and very awesome. And who can endure it? Well, at the end we find out very few do endure it. Mortal man becomes scarcer than pure gold. And where are all these great and mighty men, these military guys who boasted and vaunted themselves against God? They're hiding in the rocks and dens and caves of the earth praying for bloody mercy. Please save us from the mean little lamb. That's kind of the irony there. They talk about this. Normally lambs aren't viewed, you know, they're docile little creatures and they're harmless and all of that. Save us from the little lamb. Again, it reminds me of that deal in Monty Python, the rabbit that came out. He's vicious. You say, it was just a bunny rabbit. Ah, yeah, but you don't know. Well, the little lamb, when he decides to turn it on, watch out. Because they know who's coming after him. And they don't care for it. They're scared to death. It's called great and terrible. Also, Malachi 4:5. And believe me, it's terrible for most people. Even those that get through it, it's going to be difficult on them. Behold, I am going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. The terrible aspect refers to the judgment, the first part of it. And that's why Elijah has to be on the planet before the day of the Lord begins. This is another one of those little prepositions that helped me finally put this together. He's going to be sent before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord. So Elijah has to be on the planet before this all starts. And as far as we know, along with the Antichrist, Moses and Elijah appear just after the rapture. So there's going to be a brief period, however long, I don't know. Whatever, maybe it's only a second, a split second in human time. But there'll be no believers on the planet at all for a split second. And maybe longer, I don't know. I mean, it just depends on when they show up. But then there'll be two immediately, the two prophets, which I believe most likely lead to the conversion of the 144,000. And that happens apparently pretty early in this. Again, fixing the exact time is not, I haven't been able to do that. But it occurs apparently very early. And these 144,000, where Isaiah and, or rather, Jeremiah, or Moses and Elijah will be, it appears they are confined to the land of Israel. That's where they do all their work. But the 144,000, no doubt, are spread out all over the globe. And they convert, and of course, that's that sealing deal that takes place there in Revelation 7. So, when the phrase is in those days and at that time. Oh, well, I'm sorry, point two here. Because the Jews were so familiar with this concept, it is often referred to in general terms as well, the day, which is not, you know, a huge issue. Behold, the day is coming. What day? Well, it's a day burning like a furnace, and all the arrogant and every evildoer will be chaff. And the day is coming that will set them ablaze. The Lord is coming to baptize you with the Spirit and with fire. And you hear these funny praying, singing, send your fire, O Lord. Fire is judgment, people. Fire is judgment. That's the agent of judgment. Don't send us fire. No. Well, we don't want that. So the day is coming that will set them ablaze so that I will leave them neither root nor branch. And that phrase really sticks with me when I get out into the yard and I'm weeding. I think you got to get the root. You got to make sure this thing can't come back. And that's what that phrase means. They're not coming back from this ever. There's going to be nothing left. They're not going to recover. And that's definitely coming. It's also called the day, that day. For instance, Isaiah 10:20. So, again, because they were more familiar with this, probably than most people are, it didn't have to be always made explicit. Now, in that day, the remnant of Israel and those of the house of Jacob who have escaped will never again rely on the one who struck them. They will truly rely on the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. A remnant will return, the remnant of Jacob, to the mighty God. And we saw this emphasized by Paul there in Romans 9, 10, and 11 specifically, that it is a remnant. It's only a few that believe. For though your people, O Israel, may be like the sand of the sea. And I think Paul cited these verses, if I remember right. Only a remnant within them will return. A destruction is determined, overflowing with righteousness. For a complete destruction, one that is decreed, the Lord God of the armies will execute in the midst of the whole land. So it's called that day. You can see also 11:10. It's called in those days. Joel 3:1, and we saw that one, and at that time, Zephaniah 3:20. So when the phrases in those days and at that time are combined, the emphasis is really on the blessing and exaltation of Israel under the Messiah. Jeremiah 33:15. So when you combine these phrases, and that's actually, we've seen that one, that's the time the righteous branch of David springs forth. And the branch, by the way, is a term for Messiah. And there's another branch that's talked about who's very likely the Antichrist. But again, Satan has a counterfeit for everything. If this is the true branch, well, this is the fake branch. This is the pseudo branch. And in those days, Judah will be saved and Jerusalem will dwell in safety. Well, do you think that's really going on today? For the preterists who claim all this has been fulfilled, does that really look like what you see in the world today? That Israel is safe and fine and Jerusalem is safe and fine? No, not by any stretch. And this is the name by which she will be called. The Lord is our righteousness. We saw those 54 and 20, and we saw Joel 3:1 also too. B, Greek terms like the Hebrew counterpart, the phrase hemera kuriu, with or without the definite article, is translated as the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is a unique period in history, and so therefore it doesn't always have to have the article with it to be translated as the day of the Lord. But because it's like the sun. When we talk about the sun, we never say a sun. Because it's definite. There's only one of them. There's only one day of the Lord. Now, it's an extended period of time, grant you that. But there's only one, and so it doesn't have to have the article to be emphasized. So it is translated as day of the Lord four times in the New Testament. Acts 2:20 is a citation of the Joel passage. And it was in that time where Peter makes an application off of this prophecy. He doesn't say this is the full fulfillment of it. This fulfills the word of the Lord. He could have said that. Because there's other places in the New Testament where that's said. This fulfilled what the prophet had said. But what he says here in verse 16 is this is what was spoken of through Joel. He's not claiming this is the total fulfillment of this prophecy. But he's claiming a partial fulfillment here at least. And we have that, as I told you, when we did the introduction to the studies of prophecy. You have prophecies that often have a near fulfillment and have a more distant fulfillment. The more distant fulfillment is the final one. It is the one which wraps up the particulars of the prophecy. But the near fulfillment may have aspects of that prophecy that come true, but it doesn't fulfill it entirely. And certainly at this time, it was not fulfilled entirely. Acts chapter 2, verse 20. The sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the great and glorious day of the Lord shall come. Also, 1 Thessalonians 5:5. doesn't use the term here, day of the Lord, but it talks about the day. We're sons of the day. And that means that our destiny, our future, is to be a part of that. Obviously, light is the time of day, and we get that as well, that we are to live in the light, function in the light, which is obviously a synonym for the truth and doctrine. But you are not in darkness. That the day, and in context, in 5:2, he's clearly talking about the day of the Lord because he uses that phrase. You yourselves know full well that the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. And actually, you know, that's supposed to be 5:2 there. Change that. That's where he actually uses the phrase. I probably messed that up with, and the next one said 2:2, so I may have got those just mixed up. But that's all right. But our destiny is to be a part of all this, the millennial kingdom. Now, not in the human physical body, but in resurrection bodies. And that to be a son of something means to exemplify that, or that you are a part of that. That is your nature, the son of perdition, the one who is destined for hell forever. Here, sons of the day. So, again, we don't walk like the world does. We're not supposed to anyway. In ignorance, because of the darkness that's in them, because of their hardness of heart. Because they're not teachable. They're not humble. They're not positive. Well, we don't want to be like that. Also, 2 Thessalonians 2:2. And here the Thessalonians, as we know, had probably received some spurious communication, a letter that was purported to be written by Paul, and sent them false information. And they apparently bought into it. We know that one of the false doctrines going around at that time, we see it later in the Timothy epistles, was that the resurrection has already happened. And that appears to be part of this theology. That the day of the Lord has already arrived. The day of the Lord has come, as he says. Don't be quickly shaken from your composure or disturbed. Why? Because false doctrine destabilizes people. When you believe false doctrine, you're not stable. And sound doctrine is designed to stabilize us, to give us confidence before the Lord that comes from knowing the truth. And so, that if you've received a spirit or a message or a letter as if from us, to the effect that the day of the Lord has come, well, let no one in any way deceive you, for the day of the Lord cannot come unless the apostasy comes first and the man of lawlessness is revealed. There you go, son of destruction. Characterized by and headed for destruction. That's all Antichrist is. And until you see the Antichrist, you can't say the day of the Lord has started. So, again, throughout history, people are constantly wanting to set dates and identify things. For a while there, you know, I think Hitler was the Antichrist, and then it was Kennedy, and now it's whoever it was Obama, I think, for a bunch of them. He's clearly he is an Antichrist, don't get me wrong, but not the Antichrist. Most of these people probably were Antichrist. There's no doubt about that. But to identify him and identify him wrongly sends people the wrong message. And that's another thing that gets people off their feet. Quit trying to fix out a time for the rapture. You don't know. No one knows. It's nonsense to do that. Jesus made it very plain, the day and the hour, no man, not an angel, not even the Son. You say, well, maybe the Son knows now. Maybe he does, but he hasn't told me. Even if he does know, you can't know. That's the whole point of this. We can have a general time frame. But if God wanted us to know the day of the rapture, and I wish he did. I really do. I would regulate my wine consumption so that I ran out the day before. I don't want to leave a bunch of good wine here for unbelievers to drink. And that's what they'll get, though. Assuming, I guess, they don't cut off the power and ruin it all. So, again, you've got to see the Antichrist on the scene before you can even begin to say the day of the Lord has arrived. And I think actually there, and let me check that one, but I think it actually uses a different verb there. Here. No, it's anastami. Okay, to stand in. Okay, I thought it was heko. That's a different verb that means arrived. And then the last one is 2 Peter 3:10. And again, this is in the context of the prophecy regarding the last days, when the doctrines of uniformitarian evolution become the dominant scientific theories, and uniformity of planet Earth, uniformity of time and history and all that. Nothing's ever changed. It's all the same as it was. And uniformity of evolution, that things are evolving. It's funny, I was watching a movie last night. It wasn't particularly good, but what can you do? So I was watching this movie, and this guy sitting there, he's holding this little frog. And he said, look at this little frog. And you're looking at it. Okay, it's a little frog. He goes, millions of years of history, and this little frog hasn't changed. I thought, good. You're right, it hasn't. Evolution is not true. And if you thought about it, man hasn't changed either. But they don't, and again, there's not a missing link in the evolutionary chain. There is no chain. That's the problem. You just have individual links that are not even connected. There's huge missing links. So the last days, when this is the dominant scientific theory, and people are mocking, making fun of everything doctrinal. That's the new agenda. And make fun of everything doctrinal. Make jokes about the rapture. Okay. Keep making them. And then, when you're left behind, we'll see what happens. But if you're in New York, you know you're the center of the universe and nothing can go wrong. Or at least that's what they're going to think. Well, here, as he says, and this is where we get the 7,000 years of human history. Verse 8, don't let this fact escape your notice. With the Lord, one day is like 1,000 years. And 1,000 years like one day. And so most just interpret this in a general way and say God doesn't deal with time the same way we deal with time. Which, how does that help you refute uniformitarian evolution? No, it's telling us here that the divine week, why did God work for 6 days and rest one? Why is there a 7-day week, not a 10-day week, not a 40-day week? I mean, how many days could you put in a week? How many ever God wanted to? But it's seven. And he works off of that figure a lot, as we know. So this actually fixes for us a period, a divine week. And this is the answer to the question, how long does Satan have to appeal his case? Because that's where we are. We're in the appeal stage at this point. Satan has clearly been sentenced, the punishment is prepared, and yet not executed. And so, there's no doubt, as we know, Satan objected, number one, to God being the judge of all these things. How you're not impartial, you're involved in this, it's you I'm attacking, so you can't judge me righteously. Oh yeah, I can. I just won't respond to any of your idiot stupidity stuff and negative volition, and I will judge you perfectly. I won't take any of this personally. Although God created him, you got to think it's a little personal. But he says, as a judge, I don't have to recuse myself. Satan wants God recused as the judge of these things. Well, God's not going to. He can't. By the nature of the conflict, there's only one who could judge it, and it's God. And so, as he says, here, the time is coming, and I give you X amount of time. Whatever your appeal is, it's a limited. And the same thing's true even in our society today, as bad as it is. Unfortunately, as you know, appeals can drag out and drag out and drag. And you'll hear something about, they're finally executing this guy after 20 years because he's now exhausted all his appeals. Well, God is answering all of Satan's appeals in the angelic conflict. And amazingly enough, using people like you and me to do it. Now, go figure. That's astonishing to me. I mean, once you know who you are, why would you use me? I think you have a problem, Lord. I'm not sure what it is. But, you feel humbled, you don't feel worthy, and we're not. But that's why Jesus came. That's why he died in our place. Because we weren't good enough. We were never going to be good enough. You're not going to, and by the way, after you get saved, the old man doesn't change. He doesn't say, I've seen the light. Hallelujah. The sin nature is what it is. And it continues to be a function after salvation, as Paul detailed it there in Romans 7. Wretched man that I am. Not that I used to be, that I am now. And he knew the fight against the sin nature and the difficulty and how it just beats you down and you sometimes just have enough of it. But we're never going to be good enough. But he's going to use us to prove Satan's wrong. As we exercise faith and adhere to God's plan, every application, every doctrine you embrace is a nail in his coffin. That God is right in all of this. Satan is not. And anyone that follows him is doomed. Whether they follow him knowingly, as a third of the angels did, or unknowingly. And the argument, well, the human race doesn't know what it's into. Why not? I do. You do. Why don't they get it? Well, they don't want to get it. They hate the light. They avoid the light. They don't come to the light because why? Their deeds are evil. And they're committed to that evil. In spite of everything to the contrary that they shouldn't be. They are. So here, our verse here, as he says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief. First, it takes everyone by surprise. That's the thief motif. You don't know. The thief doesn't call you. Hello? I'm going to be over 10:30 tonight. You going to be busy? You don't have a gun, do you? The thief doesn't do that. They just had a deal. I don't know if you saw it on TV, but some guy walks up and this maybe this is the thing to get. Get one of those, whatever it's called, a keyhole camera or a doorbell camera. And it's triggered by motion. This guy comes up to her house and they get a great picture of him. Surprise. You're on TV now. And then he goes around and breaks into a window and gets in the house and she scares him off. But my word, the thief doesn't check with you. God's not going to notify anybody about this. Even for believers, if the rapture was to happen right now, I'd be the most shocked of anybody. But literally, there's nothing that I know that's preventing it other than God's timing. I mean, prophetically, I don't know that there's much preventing it. So when it happens, where are you going to be? McDonald's? Well, someplace healthier maybe, I don't know. At the gym? Praying? Sleeping? What are you going to be doing? Watching TV? But whenever it happens, I guarantee you, you're going to be shocked. You're going to be surprised. Because nobody knows. We have a general time frame. We know he's coming. But not exactly when. So here, as he says, the day of the Lord will come like a thief, in which the heavens will melt away with a roar, will pass away with a roar. And the elements will be destroyed with intense heat. And the earth and all its works will be burned up. And so, again, this nonsense about living in eternity with without a resurrection body, that you're going to live in a mortal body, nonsense. You can't do that. When God speaks the elements out of existence, that's going to be very hard on a carbon-based life form. And whether you know it or not right now, you are a carbon-based life form. And that's going to have to go. So this ties the day of the Lord to the very destruction of the material universe at the end of the millennium. Which, how much after is it? I don't know. There seems to be small, unspecified periods of time, say between the end of the age of Israel and then the actual, quote, outset of the millennium. There's like 75 days or something that's unaccounted for. And which I assume that's the cleanup period. Now, obviously, God could clean it all up just like I Dream of Jeannie, you know. He could do that, but he doesn't. So there's a 75-day period referenced in Daniel. And then is there another little period here at the end of the millennium when he speaks this out? Or does that right at the end of the 1,000 years, he speaks it out of existence and that sets up the great white throne? Because, again, you're not going to survive this in a human body. The conflagration that's coming. The heavens and the earth will pass away with a roar. Not just the earth. And the elements will be destroyed with intense heat. Hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium. What's the element that has the greatest melting temperature? It'll be higher than that. Because it's going to melt them all. And so, again, if you don't have a resurrection body, you're not going to withstand this. There's no way. So, obviously, there's another. You hear about the first resurrection, but you never hear about the second and the third one, but it's implied that there are more than one. Certainly, the second resurrection is the resurrection of all unbelievers. But is there a third resurrection for believers in which they have to be translated into their resurrection bodies to go into the eternal state? I think that there is. I think that there has to be. If the world as we know it's going to pass out of existence. So that's our last one there. It is, it's referenced four times. And each one contributes a little bit to our understanding. That it's a partial fulfillment of Joel. That it comes suddenly on people. They're unprepared. That it is the answer to the evil of the last days. Well, two, it is called the day of judgment, since it is characterized by fire, destruction, and the various judgments Jesus Christ will execute. Matthew 10:15. And it's not, again, necessarily just a single day, as you might imagine. Judgment takes a while. God could have judged everything all at once. He doesn't. He's got reasons for that. Truly I say to you, it will be more tolerable for the land of Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. And that might comprise first the destruction of the city physically during the, quote, great and terrible day of the Lord. Or it might refer to them as the last judgment, which comes 1,000 years later. Both are a part of that day of the Lord. So which judgment is in view? And maybe both, I don't know. But they would technically occur, we might say, in the day of the Lord. Also, 2 Peter 2:9, passing. Well, we're just there. I take that back. We weren't there. We were in 3. Then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment for the purpose of the day of judgment, for judging them then. He knows how to handle all this. And then he defines some of the unrighteous characteristics, those that indulge the flesh. And also 3:7, same book. By his word, at his will, the present heavens and earth are being reserved for fire, being kept for the day of judgment and the destruction of ungodly men. And that whole day would encompass everything from the beginning of the day of the Lord to their destruction at the great white throne when they're cast into the lake of fire. There they endure permanent destruction. Never to die, they're not annihilated. They're consciously alive forever, being constantly destroyed. And all that entails. Our time is gone. We're going to have to stop there today, so we will continue to plow through this on Tuesday. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to assemble together. Thank you for the information you provide through your Spirit. We pray that you would sanctify this to our spiritual growth, for we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.